Hello, I'm Jane Crowther, editor of Total Film, and welcome to the subscriber version of Inside Total Film. And as always, thank you for taking out a subscription. We really appreciate it. Today, I'm joined by our deputy editor, Matt Matem.
Hello.
Which he managed to say without sounding like he had an orange in his mouth, which he does. And our contributor, Ashanti Onker.
Hi.
Hello again, Ashanti. Two in a row, joining us as an almost permanent member of the team here.
I am loving it.
We're loving having you. So this week, we are rating Marvel's latest, Shang-Chi. We think we've said that right. Musical Annette, family drama Wildfire, and the documentary Misha and the Wolves. But before we get started on those, what have you been watching this week? Ashanti, I know you've been up for a little bit of murder.
Oh, gosh. I saw Only Murders in the Building a few months ago because Hulu sent it to me. And I thought, let's just watch one episode. Let's see how it is. Absolutely loved it. And I know we will be talking about that a bit later. But Disney did a very special thing at Spitalfields Market. They turned it into the Arconia and we were able to experience it, including like hot dogs and pizza. They made it feel like a bit of New York in London. So that was real fun. I have been watching some other things that have made me really happy. One is Marvel's What If. I'm sure both of you have seen it. And wow, I went into it with a lot of skepticism. I didn't really know whether I'd like it at all. And after episode one, I was hooked. And episode two had the king himself, Chadwick Boseman. All of us have been remembering him at this time of year, especially. It made me really emotional because that was like the last piece of work he did for them. Mm. And the team behind this didn't know what was going on in his life. They didn't know that very soon afterwards, after they'd recorded these things over Zoom, actually, with him, that he would sadly pass away. And, you know, this kind of keeps his legacy living on. And this particular episode, you know, it's humorous. You know, what happens if Chala and Star-Lord mix up in the Marvel Universe? That was really lovely. And, you know, what happens, all of us think this, I'm sure, at some point in our lives, if one choice goes differently, and if it's like sliding doors, right?
Mm-hmm.
If you don't go into that carriage on a train, what happens to your life? So the way they've thought this up is amazing, and I absolutely love it. And apparently his voice, Chadwick Boseman's voice, will pop up again in other episodes. So
yes, I've heard that as well.
Right? Mm-hmm. I am so excited for that. And the other thing I watched, I don't know if you both have, and I'm not sure if you're into the kind of romantic genre of films. Matt's laughing because he probably is not at all. He's like, no.
He's just a massive romantic. That's what he's laughing at, because he's just like, I love it. He just loves a rom-com, does Matt?
In
he
real
anything
life.
With Kate Hudson, don't you? No, he doesn't.
No.
He's got that look on his face.
I am a romantic, though, just not romantic comedies like that. I like romantic films.
So this one is not really, it's not a comedy. It's called Really Love. It's on Netflix. And Angel Kirsty Williams has made this film. It's got Kofi Siribo, who I like very much. He's in Queen Sugar. That's where I saw him for the first time. And that was made by Ava DuVernay. And loved this man and his work. And this girl, Yutha Wong Loy Singh, I hope I'm pronouncing that right, a Stevie. So this is the love story between Isaiah and Stevie. And it's got this fantastic cast, because the minute I see Blair Underwood in anything, I have a propensity to watch it. And, you know, I was an LA Law fan and I love his work. And this guy just has not aged at all. And Uzo Aduba, who was in Orange is the New Black, and Powers Naturi Norton, and Barbershop's Michael Ealy. I mean, these are all beautiful people, excellent actors, all on screen. And it's set in Chocolate City, Washington, D.C. And it's becoming all gentrified. It's all about this artist and this aspiring lawyer who meet, you know, they meet at this art exhibition. Vision, they have this moment together and they fall in love. You know, like it's a late night movie you watch, have a favorite beverage at hand, and you can just kind of take a deep dive into Black love. Really Love, it's on Netflix. And if you've seen films like If Beale Street Could Talk or Photograph that has Issa Rae and Lakeith Stanfield, you know, this film is a film for you.
Good sell there. Are you on commission? Well done.
Netflix, Amy, I'm really excited.
Yeah, she says this as she's from her Netflix corner office. She isn't. She's in a lounge. Matt, what have you been watching?
Well, I've been watching something much shorter. I basically got access to a couple of the new, I don't know if I'm allowed to sort of say much about them, so I'll kind of gloss over, but access to a couple of the new Pixar Sparks shorts that are going on to Disney Plus that are sort of like the experimental kind of shorts they do, where they just try them out with different filmmakers and different kind of styles of animation and everything like that. So, but yeah, I'm pretty sure they're under embargo, so I can't really go into details about those. But
you could just you have seen them, though.
I've seen them, and I really enjoy the previous ones. Let's put it that way. You know, some of those are really moving. Like, I don't know if you've seen, like, there's one called Out that I really like, and there's one called Kitbull, and they're all between, you know, kind of like 5 and 10 minutes, but they're really moving. And if like me, you end up quite frequently watching them on like a Saturday morning at like an ungodly hour, then you often do have to find like excuses for getting a bit of dust in your eye with these, you know, and they're just really inventive, you know. So I really enjoy those. And there's some new ones coming soon. And also in a similar vein, I also got access to see some episodes of Doug Days, which is the spin-off of Doug the Dog from Up. And that's just really delightful, and kind of comes at a sort of poignant time where we've just lost Ed Asner.
I know.
And Carl Fredrickson, obviously one of his kind of defining roles for a particular generation. You know, he does appear as Carl in this series, so it's kind of a final performance from him as well you can enjoy. But yeah, and I think by the time I'm saying this, I think it's actually going to be at least some episodes. I don't know how they're dropping, but at least the first episode will be on Disney Plus, I think, by the time you actually listen to this. So you can check it out as well.
I have been watching Back to the Future. It was bank holiday and we sat down to watch Back to the Future because I hadn't seen it for a little while, and just loved it all over again, as I always do. But I did then get to think, why are Marty and Doc friends? How on earth did they meet and get together? And is it appropriate? I mean, like the headmaster says, what are you hanging out with that weirdo Doc Brown for? And you have to ask, why is Marty McFly hanging out with this mad scientist and turning up at his house and has a key to his house? Where's the prequel of how these two met and why they get on together and what their interests are? Like, I hadn't really considered this before. And that, you know, they're really good friends, as we see through the whole of this series. And, you know, they'll essentially sort of step in front of a bullet for each other, sort of thing. But where's this started for a 17-year-old boy and a mad scientist? How did they meet? This is something I want to know, and it troubled me.
The thing which troubles me the most about Back to the Future these days is now 1985 is longer ago than 1955 was when the film came out. Like, how is that possible? Yeah. Like, us going back to 1985 is the equivalent of Marty going back to 1955. It's just, yeah, that's more disturbing. So that's what troubles me more.
Isn't just the very act of having plutonium in like a car park in the valley, aren't they just exposing any residents nearby to like terrible sort of fallout and things? And I probably needed
to not... You ruined
Back
to the Future, basically.
I did. I sort of had questions that I hadn't thought of before. So if there is answers to this, maybe there's Back to the Future nerds out there that do know how Marty and Doc met and how it was perfectly safe to be just kicking plutonium around in a car park in LA. Let me know. I'd love to know that. Shall we have a look then to something that is of this era? It's time to brush off your martial arts for this.
My name. Start a new life. But I could never escape his shadow.
So this is Shang-Chi. I think I said it right. There is great discussion in this film about how to say this to comedic effect. So I hope I did that justice. Matt, tell us about this. Yeah. What is it about?
So Shang-Chi and the Legend of the Ten Rings, it's called. So let's start actually with the Ten Rings, like the film does. So basically, we start with a character called Wen Wu, played by a Hong Kong star, Tony Leung, in his first Hollywood role. Broadly speaking, he's a bad guy. And there's actually this really great prologue where we learn more about him and these magical Ten Rings that he's come into possession of, which grant him these special powers. Yeah, I won't say too much about that because it's fun to kind of discover that prologue yourself. But along the way, he has a son and daughter. The son is called Shang-Chi, and the daughter is also a significant character who we're going to meet later in the film. And obviously, given the title, we soon jump ahead to when Shang-Chi is a young man. Only now he's known as Sean. And instead of being some sort of badass assassin in the mold of his father, he's now a valet living in San Francisco and just kind of hanging around and having fun with his pal and colleague Katie, who's played by Awkwafina. And they're just basically valeting by day and just doing karaoke drunkenly in the evenings.
I can get down with that. I'm totally into that.
I mean, exactly. Yeah. I'm sure like her family would kind of call them slackers, but they're sort of enjoying their life without any major commitments and responsibilities until they're riding the bus one day and a very scary looking dude comes to attack Sean. And from there, his past sort of comes back to haunt him. And that's where the story kind of jumps off from, really.
Yeah. And what a bus fight. I mean, this is amazing, right? Did you guys enjoy this? I mean, this is the introduction to the sort of martial arts we're going to see in this film. We do get a bit, as you say, with that introduction to the father figure, but to sort of understand what we're going to get from actually Shang-Chi himself, this bus ride is the sort of calling card for his prowess. How was it for you? I mean, I thought this was some of the best action I'd seen in like the Marvel universe, frankly. I thought it was amazing, this fighting. Did you?
100%. I was totally immersed in this film. I went in worried that they wouldn't give this full justice because we haven't heard at all about Shang-Chi, though we've heard a lot about, well, a little bit about the Ten Rings, I suppose, in previous films. And, you know, just the fact that they've got people like Michelle Yeoh in it, the film has these fantastic scenes. Every scene, it's like what you see in that trailer is just a very tiny bit of what you'll see on that big screen because it'll have you riveted scene by scene. And like Benedict Wong in this, he's really cool. Fala Chen, I just absolutely loved what she was doing in this because we don't get to see female superheroes very much. And especially on the big screen, we are seeing a lot more on the smaller screen these days, but seeing these two come together, I mean, Awkwafina, not quite a superhero in this, but
not yet.
You're right, not yet. There are two important end credit scenes, so all I can say is, without giving away spoilers, there's a lot to come from this, and we will see more of them. So do watch this one. It's really good to see this mythology of the Ten Rings. I didn't really know too much about it. I went and did more reading after watching the film. Because the film kind of does all the talking. It does all that historical stuff. And it also then brings everyone to the present time. And, you know, the dragon scene, that was incredible. It kind of evoked for me Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, House of the Flying Daggers, Enter the Dragon. You know, once upon a time in China, those kind of Jackie Chan type sequences, which I thought were really meticulously crafted. I think they really did due diligence with bringing East Asia to the MCU, which is something we had been waiting to see. And with the Eternals, we'll be seeing a little bit of the South Asian side as well. But with this, they've just come out and said, we are giving this guy, you know, a full film for himself. And for me, I loved Simu in Kim's Convenience. Yeah. I watched every single episode of that. He was fantastic. And you know, that slacker kind of character that he had at the beginning of Kim's Convenience is what we see him as in some way. So they're almost bringing those of us who were fans of that straight into this very nicely. And then you see him evolve. And I love anything where you see the evolution of a character. And this does it all right. Everything for me worked. The music was great as well. I loved the kind of East Asian motifs that they used to bring that, you know, the soundscapes to life. And the visuals, wow. I mean, the dragon, I don't want to say anything.
Yeah, else. I mean, no spoilers. Yeah. But I mean, did that work for you, Matt? I mean, obviously, there's this idea that it's hardcore sort of martial arts and you're getting amazing fight sequences that are, you know, quite grounded on a bus, a metro bus, the number one that goes through San Francisco, up Nob Hill and down those hills and towards Ghirardelli Square and knocks a load of cars out. But also you're getting this sort of mythology and this side of the creatures that we understand in the mythology. Did you like that, the fact that those two worlds sort of collided in this?
This was the one thing I actually had slightly mixed feelings on, because overall I really enjoyed it and have agreed with a lot of what's been said so far. But it was partly because I was just so enjoying the kind of the hand-to-hand combat and the sort of kung fu of those early scenes and getting to know the character in that way. On first view, which I've only seen it once, I felt almost like a tiny bit like, oh, I wish the balance had been, we'd got a little bit more kind of grounded kung fu hand-to-hand combat action and then a little bit less of the fantasy. But then, to be honest, as I've sort of thought about it more afterwards, I've kind of sort of grown to appreciate it more in my mind than perhaps I did at the time. And I kind of, now I sort of think back fondly on those kind of big fantasy sequences that you talk about. But yeah, maybe I would have just liked just a little bit more of the straightforward kung fu action that I was enjoying. Yeah. How about you?
For me, and this is no disrespect to it, it reminded me of Kung Fu Panda, which I absolutely love. And this sort of really, really lovely guy, a man, not a panda, that is actually destined for greatness and is like this absolute master of martial arts. but also has this huge heart. And the fact that it's sort of the beautiful sort of visuals of it, I could totally get on board with the dragon and the other creatures, of which we probably shouldn't go into too much detail for spoilers, but there are some quite amazing creatures in this, and a beautiful sort of forest that's almost alive. I didn't think that that would be my thing, but I really liked it. I thought it had so much heart to it, and I felt really emotionally engaged with them because of what the dragon sort of symbolized to this whole endeavor, and the need for, you know, we've seen these stories before where people have to sort of fulfill their prophecy, or, you know, find a way to sort of fulfill their potential. But I felt that it did it really, really well here. And it wasn't just about him fulfilling his potential, but it was also about his friend Katie. It was about his sister. It was about everything really coming together, and who we want to see reflected back in the mirror when we look at the mirror. I notice there's loads of scenes with reflected surfaces in this film. And it's all about this guy finding a way to look at himself in the mirror and be happy with what he sees and feel proud of himself. And I thought that that was really great. But aside from that, there's an amazing fight sequence on some scaffolding off the side of a Macau building that's sort of a little bit Skyfall, isn't it? With all of the sort of lights reflecting and people fighting. I loved that. And Awkwafina, just, she's great. And building on her Raya and the Last Dragon character almost here, sort of just that witty banter. I loved the relationship between her and him, and that, you know, that they were, as you say, karaoke king and queen, but also sort of she took the piss out of him at every available opportunity because she was his best friend and she had his back. I loved it. So this is big talk. I think it's the Marvel film I've enjoyed the most in like a really long time. Yeah, it was a total winner for me.
Very good. Yeah, I think they just absolutely nailed it on the casting, as they quite often do in Marvel. But sort of with Simu Liu, for example, it was a bit like for me with like Chris Pratt in Guardians of the Galaxy, where you sort of get this like instant movie star. And like, not only does he kind of convince in the action stakes, but he's also just really funny and immensely likable. And you just kind of want to be best friends with him, like you do with Awkwafina as well. Although we obviously kind of, I knew her more beforehand because I'd never seen Kim's Convenience. But again, she's someone you just kind of want to hang out with. And she's sort of a great like entry point into the world because she's just kind of, you know, she's the sort of human, you know, no powers. And she's sort of tagging along with her friend. So we get her sort of perspective on everything. And I just sort of love spending time with those two. And yeah, just obviously can't wait to see them more in the MCU.
Yeah, and I loved also that he had his armor that he was made. And even when he's in full outfit, he's still wearing jeans and trainers. He's still that guy, you know, that scrappy guy from San Francisco, but with this amazing power. So just, I thought he was just a really great superhero. I loved it.
I love Tony Leung as well. I really thought he added a lot to this. Just so kind of brooding and just sort of quite a sort of conflicted kind of character, like not just a straight up baddie, you know, like not a scenery chew or anything like that. And yeah, I just thought, yeah, he was just great.
It is a way for Marvel to address the concerns people had about what they did with the Mandarin in Iron Man
3.
Were you happy that they actually held their hands up and said, look, we didn't do that correctly. We sort of made a mess of that. And they've sort of readdressed it here.
I certainly felt happier because there was a concern, I think, from day one. And I think Kevin Feige already, in one of the interviews he did straight off the premiere, the world premiere that they did a few weeks ago in America, he immediately kind of addressed those concerns because in China, they were very worried that these old stereotypes that they had brought into these characters will be brought back into this film. And I feel that Marvel worked really hard. And I kind of give huge props to Destin Daniel Cretton, the director. He used a lot of behind the scenes crew and people who actually helped shape the film into what it is. And it's got that authentic feel that I was very worried it wouldn't have. I mean, most of us have probably just seen Snake Eyes as well. So going into this after seeing Snake Eyes and wondering, will this be any good? I mean, all my dreams and expectations were completely blown away when I saw what they did with Shang-Chi. And I was really hoping that, you know, with Simu, that he would be given a role like that, that could really put his talent out there. And he has worked so hard for it. And they did due diligence completely with this one.
So I think we're highly recommending that people have some fun at the cinema with this one this weekend.
Oh, yes. I'm going to go and see it again.
I think 100%. I want to, me too, I want to go see it again. I also kind of want to see it with an audience that's bigger than there was just about four people when I saw it. I'd like to see it with a bigger audience, like really cheering on Michelle Yeoh and various other people when they kick ass. Okay, so that is Shang-Chi and it's out in cinemas on Friday. Shall we move on to a Cannes darling then with this?
First time I fell in love, woke up next to the girl and escaped fast and far. The man has changed me. What I see in her is obvious. What she sees in me is... that's a little more puzzling.
One, two, three, four!
So this is Annette. I don't even want to begin to try to explain what this is about, but Matt, you can have a go at it. What is it about?
Annette is a musical and it's written actually by the Sparks Brothers, the sort of cult musicians who recently came to prominence with the Edgar Wright documentary. It was about them. They write the songs as well. And they also appear in the film briefly. And in terms of the story, it's very sort of operatic in a way. That's what I kept sort of thinking throughout. It's a very sort of, you know, broad strokes kind of story with big moments, big emotions, big characters, and it's all kind of built around the songs. And I should also say it's directed by Leos Carax, who did Holy Motors. So that should give you some sort of indication of how bonkers it is if you've seen that film. The basic gist is you've got Henry McHenry, played by Adam Driver, who's a kind of avant-garde stand-up comedian, and he falls into a sort of whirlwind romance with opera star Anne de Franu, if I pronounce that correctly. And before long, they have a baby who's called Annette, where the film gets its title from. But the way the baby is presented in the film is as quite an obviously sort of fake puppet. And that continues from that baby as she kind of grows up into a sort of small girl. The story kind of goes from there, really, as Anne becomes sort of ever more successful and Henry's career starts to flounder. That's the setup. But, you know, Jane, I know you weren't a fan of this film, were you?
No. No. I mean, this is exactly the sort of film that is just the word that wanky is used for. I mean, this is such wankiness, like... Adam Driver's a comedian, but nothing he says is funny. The songs, like, I know Sparks. I love Sparks. Mm. They've done some great songs. But aside from the first one where it's like, can't we start? The rest of it was just like people taking the piss. Are you actually joking with this? Like, you know, there's scenes with him and her sort of writhing around naked going, we're so in love, we're so in love, we're so in love. And then this bloody baby turns up and it's like hideous baby child thing that sings apparently beautifully, but it's awful. It's like a singing child from my nightmares. Everything about this is what I hate. And frankly, I didn't want to watch it at all. If I had paid to see this in the cinema, within 5 minutes, I would have been like, oh God, I'm stuck with this now. And I would have been quite upset that I hadn't spent it on something else. I hated it. Ashanti.
So maybe I was reading a lot into it. It was very pretentious. And I agree with everything you've said. I read the preamble about it and I thought, oh, this is, you know, when they say magical baby, you know, maybe a special child or maybe a mystical child. What I didn't expect was a puppet baby, which was very perturbing to see, especially when it was delivered.
Yes.
The film as a whole, I mean, this idea of examining toxic masculinity, you know, I thought, okay, this is what this film is about. I'm going to get into it. It was a tough watch, I'm not going to lie. And I don't know if either of you saw The Man Who Killed Don Quixote. Yeah, yes. I felt like I was watching that again because Adam Driver is back in this and, you know, very, very long, pretentious film. And, you know, and I don't want to kind of spoil it and tell people if the baby actually becomes a real girl, like in Pinocchio. Yeah. The thing is, I liked the idea of the child examining why her dad is a toxic male and the fact that it's through her lens, then things kind of change. I was thinking that the intimacy coordinator on this would have worked really hard on this.
Oh, with perfectly placed hands over boobs. but glistening and reedy thin voices. We love each other. Honestly, Matt, did you like it?
I have to say, I actually did like it more.
Come on.
Obviously, I'd give huge caveats to anyone going to see it. It's very much like an art film with like a capital A. If your taste is sort of conventional and, you know, you just don't think you'll be up for it, I'd say just please don't go. It does really sort of require you to be willing to kind of go with and accept those pretensions. But on the most part, I actually did like the songs and I just found it really funny a lot of the time. Like, I just thought it was kind of, if it was just pure pretension, I wouldn't have liked it. But I think because I could sense they were obviously trying to be funny. It was obviously like, you know, it had quite a sort of anarchic spirit in that sense and felt like they were sort of, you know, messing with you. I sort of got into it and there was a few bits that did really make me sort of laugh out loud. And I like the way you get the different kind of aspects to it. Like occasionally you see things from the perspective of like sort of gossipy news channels on TV and things like that. And there's a sort of quite a crucial bit revolving around a performance at what they call the Hyper Bowl, which is obviously kind of this world's spin on the Super Bowl and just things like that. So we should stress this is a long film as well. It's kind of like, you know, 2.5 hours. So even
which
then,
I will not be getting back in my life.
Towards the end, I was a bit like, you know, I was quite tired towards the end. But, you know, on the most part, I enjoyed it. And I think like, for me, I think if I pay to go and sit at the cinema, I think, you know, there's a lot to kind of get out of it, a lot to chew on. I would feel like I got my money's worth there for a night in the cinema. Just kind of the imagery, the scale of the performances, you know, it leaves you with a few talking points as well. So on that note, it was kind
which
of
which is
overall,
like, are they taking the piss? Which is the talking point I wished. So it's like, honestly, I felt like it was some sort of weird Emperor's New Clothes experiment. Like, I clearly have missed the point entirely on this, but. I mean, people are talking about Driver as an Oscar nominee come awards season. Do you think this is stuff that's going to, you know, get him into the gong circle?
No, I think it's far too weird for that. It's far too weird for sort of Academy and most awards bodies' tastes, I think.
But awards bodies do like to award films about fame and about being a star. They love a film about being a star or the movies or, you know, the machinery behind fame. And that's what this does sort of try to explore. So maybe.
As there's such love for the Sparks Brothers at the moment, I could see them kind of getting something out of it, you know.
And they do appear in it, don't they, briefly at the beginning.
They do.
Doing that piano playing.
I think that the ending felt satisfying to me. That's what I would say. And I don't want to say any more, but more about that because it'll be a major spoiler. But I felt that end scene for me, I thought, okay, right. I did sit through 2.5 hours and this ending is a good payoff.
I was going to say, yeah, it's just a bit of a slog to get there.
it requires you to work hard, doesn't it? And not that I'm saying that's terrible, because obviously I do enjoy a film that challenges and that does make you work harder than just sort of shoving it into your open mouth. But yeah, this, I don't know, maybe I need to have another go. I don't think I can return. I think
unless you were hugely like drunk
and then I'm not sure that would be an improvement. So I'm saying, do not go and see this unless you're a glutton for punishment. You two, a little bit more.
Proceed with caution, yeah.
Proceed with caution.
I agree with Matt 100%. I think go in only if you're really ready to work hard, as Jane said.
Brilliant. Okay, so that is Annette, and it's out in cinemas on Friday. Take your puppet baby with you, or probably get a puppet babysitter for your puppet baby. I don't know. Okay, it's time now for alternative line reading. And in tribute to Annette, this is a line you should sing, but I'm going to say it. But I'm going to say it in the style of the person that sings it. But stiff back or stiff knees, you stand straight as Tiffany's.
Diamonds are a girl's best friend.
Correct. Gentlemen prefer blondes. Actually, I shouldn't have given you that because it's not for the song. You should have not had that because you didn't actually say the film and I did. So that's been cocked up entirely. But there we go. Half a point for Ashanti, half a point for me, even though I knew it. It is Diamonds Are a Girl's Best Friend from Gentlemen Prefer Blondes.
I would have got that, but just because of the voice. If you'd have done it in like Sean Bean voice.
You think I should have done it in Sean Bean voice? But stiff back or stiff knees, you stand straight as Tiffany's.
See, no idea. No idea. What's that called? And you can't straighten up when you bend. But stiff back or stiff knees, you stand straight at
stiff knees. Right, it's time for reunions then with this.
You said you'd keep in touch. I thought you were dead.
I hear your sister's back.
She came home herself.
Where was she? Where did the police find her? Is she okay?
Lauren!
So this is Wildfire, which, I mean, I think we've been anticipating this in coming to cinemas for about a year now. What is it about, Ashanti?
Well, this one is about two sisters. It's been billed as a drama thriller film, which I personally didn't think was the right billing for it, because this is more a deep story about two sisters who have lost their mother, and one sister has kind of gone completely haywire after her mother died, and she's disappeared for a year, and she comes back. And when she comes back to this town where her sister is, and they reunite, what happens after that? How does this whole town deal with her coming back? What happened to her mother in reality? What is that kind of PTSD that these sisters are both dealing with? And the fact that, I mean, and I only discovered this, you know, after watching the film, that one of the girls who plays one of the sisters, and this is the sister who had disappeared and comes back, had passed away.
Yeah.
Also.
Nika McGuigan, the daughter of Barry McGuigan, the boxer, died of cancer soon after this.
She died of cancer. So sad. She was so brilliant, so earnest in this role. And her with Nora Jane Noon just came together, and Kathy Brady has directed this film. And I actually was quite taken by how they put this together, how they came up with this idea of these two sisters. And I don't want to give away a spoiler, but let's just say that there's a build-up to the last scene in this film. And that scene is a very pivotal scene. And they've said it's a thriller just because it's the build-up to it. You're watching this girl and saying, what's going to happen to her? What is she doing? You know, is she going to go off the rails? Is she going to disappear at any minute and break her sister's heart again? Because, you know, they obviously love their mom very much. But also it kind of reminded me of being in a closed society where everyone is watching every move and where everyone is gossiping about you. And the whole idea of Wildfire is that the gossip is spreading like wildfire, and these two girls are having to deal with it because people are talking about their mother, who is deceased now, and they're already trying to discover what's happened to our mom. What is it that caused this death? Did she take her own life? Was it an accident? Obviously, when you lose someone close to you, there's a lot of confusion that comes with it, especially if it's something slightly more mysterious than someone who's had an illness and they've passed away. So this takes a deep dive into that, and getting these two sisters, you know, reunited, the trauma is what kind of bonds them together. But also doing this in this place where, like in Indian cinema, we'll always say, oh, those old aunties, there they are, you know, judging us at every moment. In this case, all the people that her sister worked with, they were just like those old aunties. You know, you always think of, oh, it's in the Indian film we see them, or in this African film we see them, but we see them in a film that's set in Ireland too, you know. And it was very well done, I would say, and it was quite evocative, the whole screenplay and how that rolled out. You know, I can see why it's got a high rating on Rotten Tomatoes, because initially I was a little kind of skeptical about it, but as the film drew me in, I just wanted to know and understand. And whilst they didn't delve into the mysterious side of it, you know, where they've called it a thriller, I guess, but they focus more maybe on the drama side of things, I definitely would say go and watch it if you want. In the last few years, we've all lost a lot of people in our lives, and it's almost like a bit of therapy that you see unraveling on screen for you.
I didn't love it that much. I liked what it was trying to do, and I think I see what you're saying, Ashanti, that it's this exploration of mental health in many ways, and the different ways that people cope with a traumatic incident. One sister sort of completely withdraws and the other gets on with life, and one is sort of having to be strong for both of them. And obviously the sister that comes back, Kelly, does have, you know, some mental health issues. She sort of, she tries to do the garden, completely redoes her sister's garden at 5 a.m. and she makes this very strange breakfast where she's created loads of bread that's just the crusts and strange things like that. So she's obviously dealing with a great deal of trauma, as is her sister, but her sister is reacting to it in a different way. That's fine. But it's set against also the background of the Troubles and as well as Brexit and Ireland and how they were sort of coming out of that trauma as well. So there's this sort of national trauma as well as the personal trauma, and the two are reflected in each other. And sometimes I just found that really on the nose, like just it's so blunt that I just thought it was a bit, you know, like a film I would expect from a film student rather than necessarily a feature debut. But that's my personal preference, I realise. I thought it was beautifully filmed and I did sort of like seeing a different idea of Northern Ireland, you know, the day-to-day life of it. But yeah, you know, I felt like I was sort of hit over the head with it a little bit. But as you say, there is this sort of bittersweet of watching Nika McGuigan, who shines so brightly in this, so, you know, a real sort of star in the making, and yet this is her last performance that we'll see, because she did die very quickly after she'd finished filming. So for her, it's a great testament to her talent, but I think it's quite a mediocre film, I'm afraid. However, if you want to see and tell us whether you think it's a good one or a mediocre one, do so. It's on at cinemas. Would you fancy seeing that, Matt, this weekend?
Yeah, well, after that, I've got very mixed feelings, I suppose. But, I mean, it definitely sounds intriguing, but yeah, I won't rush to it like I was planning to.
I would just add to that and agree with Matt in the sense that this is the sort of film that it's better to watch at home if it's streamed to you on one of the streaming platforms. There are some films like Shang-Chi, which you just have to see on the big screen. Whereas a film like this, you can kind of take it in. You might want to stop 2-3 times, you know, get a drink or have a nibble and then come back to it. It's not one of those films that's very easy to just watch in one stretch, is what I'd say.
That's not a great recommendation then, is it? If it's a film that you want to watch at home so you can get a drink a couple of times, it's like, oh, that's how I felt about it. But I mean, I guess the one thing is it is very sort of kitchen sink drama, in as much as it's not showy, it's not sort of flashy. Yeah. It's very much about day-to-day lives. It sort of reminded me of Clio Barnard's work, actually. That sort of very sort of gritty and very specific in place. So if you want a quiet, small drama that is about sort of emotional resonance and the sort of the trauma that we all harbour, this one will be for you. It is on at cinemas from this Friday. Okay, time for Plain Talking, where we demystify phrases that is used in film. And this week is one that we hear a lot, and this is the absolute sort of the golden snitch of cinema, four quadrant. Matt, do you know what four quadrant is?
This is actually one of those I know, and hopefully we'll be able to sum up quite easily, because it's basically used for a film that's, you know, for all audiences, basically. So dating back to when they would view things as being for older men, younger men, older women, younger women. So basically, if you've got a film that ticks all those boxes, you've got the sort of four quadrants, you know, of the audience as it was seen covered. So it's basically used for a sort of big ticket blockbuster that's like fun for all the family, as you could say, you know, the kind of thing that's going to please everyone. So, you know, Disney obviously deal in a lot of four quadrant blockbusters these days.
And that's where the money is, isn't it? Let's face it.
Exactly.
The four quadrant movie is where you're wanting to make your cash. So, yeah, we are always on the lookout for these. Jungle Cruise was a four quadrant,
yes,
wasn't it?
I was just going to say it was. And even Free Guy, BBFC has rated Jungle Cruise and Free Guy as 12 A's. But actually, I think any child can watch it with parents. And it's that big kind of family outing, perfect for a Sunday afternoon, you know, with the family. I'm sure you will be getting lots of comments about this, but I thought the new Paw Patrol movie, which is it's for under 25s, if you have kids and you want to go with them, it's not such a bad watch. Like, it's something that you won't see through it, is what I'm saying.
And those films are always only about 40 minutes long anyway, aren't they?
So it was short, very nicely short as well. And it had some really cool characters, you know, even these little female empowered, like, dogs who were doing some magical things with cool gizmos and gadgets.
Ashanti, I think you need to lie down. You need to go to a quiet room, get a wet flannel, have a little rest. What are you talking about? Anyway, she's lost it. She's lost it, listeners. She loves a Paw Patrol movie. I don't know.
No. I'm just saying that this is a good one to take kids to.
Oh, okay.
And good. You won't fall asleep while watching it.
Let's qualify that then, because I thought you'd actually lost your mind.
I mean, certainly from a marketing perspective, that's surely a two quadrant max, because you know, yeah. Although there's going to be the obligatory parents going along, it's sort of, you know, it's one of those films that's clearly aimed at, it's not in the kind of, you know, the mold of some of the Disney's and Pixar's and DreamWorks. Agreed. Where it's like,
yeah,
know,
it doesn't work on adults will get levels, a lot out of
this.
It?
It's like,
yeah,
come on, this is entertaining the kids in the holidays, you know.
Yeah, I think you'd want a longer film, frankly, for the kids, because you want to have a proper nap, don't you, when it's happening. 40 minutes just isn't enough. That's just a disco nap. You want a good sort of 90 minutes, but
well, hey, you want enough time to pop your headphones in, listen to a good podcast.
Yeah. Just keep an eye on the popcorn, make sure that nobody's fallen off their chair. That's about all I want. Okay, shall we move on then to the final film? This is certainly not a four quadrant film. This is quite the disturbing. It's a story that's stranger than fiction. It's this one.
Misha is a Holocaust survivor. She's here to tell her astonishing story.
You could have heard a pin drop.
When she was only 7 years old, she walked alone through Nazi-occupied countries, across thousands of miles, in search of her deported parents.
This story had an amazing twist.
So this is Misha and the Wolves, which is a documentary about a real life story of a woman called Misha De Fonseca, who is a Belgian woman who lived in Massachusetts and started to sort of tell people about the story of her life of being a Holocaust survivor. And that as a 7-year-old child, her parents had been taken away and she had spent her childhood wandering through the forests of Europe to escape the Nazis and had been sort of essentially cared for and nurtured by a pack of wolves, which caused a sensation locally and was then picked up by a publisher to be made into a book, which had sort of the potential to be a huge blockbuster. It was optioned for a film. It was going to be on Oprah's book club. And then things started to fall to pieces. We probably should say no more than that. But this is fascinating. And if you like sort of true crime docs on Netflix, of which, you know, my algorithm on Netflix basically offers me death, murder, cults, you know, all of this, real life documentaries all the time, because I love them. This is fascinating. And the way it's sort of been put together by the filmmakers is really interesting as well, because it absolutely wrongfoots you. And halfway through the film, you have this revelation that you're like, what? And it is that thing that's truth is stranger than fiction. Yeah, I don't want to say any really more about what actually happens, but it is a very interesting sort of exploration of small town gossips. Again, sort of a little bit like Wildfire, everybody in each other's business. The importance of remembering Holocaust survivors and what they went through and the importance of that as a society and the care that we need to take with those stories and witnesses to that event. Also just of sort of greed and psychological trauma. Again, this is a story about a little girl who has gone through trauma and her reaction to that is fascinating. It had me absolutely gripped. Did it grip you?
It did. I saw it during Sundance. I was voting with Eva for it. And I was absolutely stumped. I just did not see the twist coming, even though I'd heard about this film and even done some reading before I started watching it. And I kind of give it to the director, Sam Hopkinson, for actually looking into this and creating such a narrative for it. And, you know, taking this book where, you know, the minute they said she decided she didn't want to go on Oprah to talk about her book, and Oprah is the place to go and talk about your book if you want to make it a bestseller, that's when, you know, the alarm bells are already ringing. And the way they've depicted this and the way they created the narrative, I think, was quite smart in that sense. And I was completely wrapped. After one point, I was just sitting there thinking, oh, what's going to happen next?
Yes.
You know, And I want to give you spoilers, I really do, but I can't. So
I haven't seen it, so no spoilers for me. But
no, but I think it's best if you go in cold anyway.
Yeah.
As soon as Jane started saying that thing where she was saying, "Oh, and that's as much as I can tell you," that to me just instantly hooks me into a documentary, because I just love any of those documentaries where things just aren't quite what you expect, you know. So
This is very much Matt, you know, like in the office back in the days. Remember when we were in the office, we were always obsessed with people who were not necessarily what they appeared to be, and stories of interesting people and the whys and the wherefores of what had happened. And this is absolutely one of those. So you have to watch it, Matt. You'd love it.
It's straight up there on my list.
Yeah, it's just so interesting. But it is very interesting in as well that it doesn't cast anyone as a bad guy or a good guy. It's very murky, all of this, morally. Very murky. Yeah, it's just really, really fascinating. And they actually did make a film of this story as well, so, which I didn't see, a French film called Surviving with Wolves. So yeah, it's great to go into it knowing nothing, I would say. So we shall say no more, other than to say we would highly recommend this, yes?
We would. And I would say it would be really nice to actually learn more about her also. I feel like they gave us quite a lot of preamble, but we still came out of this thinking, I want to know more. And that was the interesting thing about it. And there's a line in it about her being a victim and a villain. And that's what I'm going to leave it with, because that's your cue to go and watch it, I think.
Yeah, it's fascinating. So that is Misha and the Wolves, which is also out in cinemas this Friday. Very good. Take your notepad, make notes, ensure you're tracking everything that's going. So this week, what are we recommending? Matt, what would you recommend people go see this weekend?
Shang-Chi will be hard to beat as a fun night out at the cinema. Obviously, I've only seen those first two films. So yeah, Shang-Chi would be my recommendation for this week.
Ashanti?
I would say hop over to Disney Plus and watch Only Murders in the Building. I mean, this combination of Steve Martin and Martin Short, we've seen many times before. We know they work. They've got the chemistry. Throw in Selena Gomez, who, you know, hasn't really done so much for us to kind of anticipate. And you start to watch this, and I guarantee you, after episode one, you're hooked. Because I really thought it'd be episode one and let's see how it goes. And I watched the whole thing back to back. I binged it completely. And let me just tell you that there are some very special guest stars in this. Mm-hmm. One is Tina Fey.
So you're happy at Tina Fey.
Well, the other one is Sting. Sting is in an episode.
Is Sting better than he is in Dune?
Yeah, I was going to say, Ashanti, I was on board until that point.
She's like, Tina Fey, you're like, yay! And then Sting, not so much.
No, but let's just say that in this, he plays a very interesting role. Again, I feel like I don't want to give spoilers with this, but it basically follows these three people who live in this very posh building in New York. And there is a murder that happens there. And they decide to create a true crime podcast and follow what happens and try and work out who has done the murder. And that's where these very interesting other characters come in. And it's essentially these two guys and girl, very young girl. It's really weird because you never expect Selena Gomez to come in and join hands with Steve Martin and Martin Short's characters. But she does. And it really works.
I love Selena Gomez's voice. Yeah. I could listen to her all day. She's got an incredible voice. Sort of like a Lauren Bacall thing going on. Maybe that's what they're trying to evoke, the sort of 1940s aspect with these two guys and her. Maybe. Yeah. Anyway.
It's very quirky and very cool is what I'd say.
It also leads me to want to plug the interview that we've got with Steve Martin and Martin Short in the new issue, which Jamie Graham did. And it's a very, very entertaining interview with the two of those guys together. So check out our June cover issue for that.
Yeah, it involves one of them wearing a dressing gown. So there we go. And it's not Jamie. Shocker. My recommendation for this week would probably be, I love Shang-Chi. I thought it was great. But if you want something a little bit quieter, Misha and the Wolves, really, really interesting. Okay, it's time to go then. But before we do, it's time for a reader's question. And this is a tough one. And I know you'll probably go, oh, my God, what's been your favourite film this year so far, Matt?
I mean, I could be a bit douchey and say that there's a couple of films I've seen that could potentially go in there, but I'm not allowed to say yet. But still at the number one spot is a film I've banged on about a lot this year. is Sound of Metal. If we're going on UK release dates, Sound of Metal is my film to beat this year, to be honest. And I'll obviously be hugely pleasantly surprised if it doesn't end up in the number one spot at the end of the year.
Ashanti.
I feel like it's a companion piece to Sound of Metal, because for me, it was Coda.
Mm.
Coda is on Apple Plus, and this was my number one vote at Sundance London, because it was one of the last films I saw in the 15 I had to vote from. And I had so many emotional responses to this film. I cried at least three times.
Oh, yeah.
You know, we've had so many coming of age stories. There are hundreds of them, right? But this is told in such an authentic way. The cast is brilliant. British actress Emilia Jones, I didn't know of her at all. And her playing this kind of the speaking, hearing and singing child of a culturally deaf family, and how she takes on the role and the responsibilities for her family. And Marley Matlin, who is an Oscar winner, I loved her in Switched at Birth. Mm. And she's just dazzling in this. And this film just did everything for me that I would expect from film, including the music that was in it. So for me, it's Coda. It's on Apple Plus, and I recommend it.
Cool. I keep thinking about The Nest, really enjoying everything about that, the way it was scripted, the economy of the script, the way it was lensed, the performances, the fact that it's not really about anything and yet it's about everything. It's one that has sort of haunted me. So I think that's going to be very high come the end of the year. But we've got loads of films to come, haven't we, for the rest of the year. So, I mean, this is obviously, we're just in September now. We've got Bond, we've got Dune, we've got so much more to come. So I think it will be very interesting when we do our top 10 at the end of the year, which we always agonize over in Total Film. And then I usually do mine and then change it at least three times. Yeah, and I go, oh, no, I need to swap that. And use my editor's privilege in an obnoxious fashion to actually claw my list back and change it again when I see other people's, because I'm like, oh, I forgot that. So, yeah, we will be asking you for yours, Ashanti, at the end of this year, when we will be doing our traditional Total Film top 10 of the year. So that's an issue to look forward to, isn't it? This many months away, but who knows? It feels like we're in December already. It's quite cold. So there we go. Anyway, on that note, it's Venice. All those people in Venice, have a lovely time, won't you? We're all here at home. So we will say goodbye and we will see you next week. Say goodbye.
Cheerio.
Bye.
Bye. Arrivederci.
Wait a minute, Doc. Are you telling me that you built a time machine out of a DeLorean?